91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we focus on another South Florida neighborhood, Miami's historic Little Havana. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Perhaps as much as South Beach, Little Havana is an international symbol of our region. Though there was a Cuban-American presence before the Cuban Revolution, in the 1960s, the area became the social, cultural, and political center of Cuban immigrant life. We'll focus on an upzoning issue in East Little Havana, the area closest to I-95. Does the neighborhood face changes? We'll speak with Miami-Dade College historian Dr. Paul George, as well as author and area tour guide Corina Mabius. And we'll take your calls. First, a brief news break. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper. Bonnie Berman has a well-deserved day off. She'll return tomorrow for our restaurant roundabout with Linda Gassenheimer. So this hour, we discuss the city of Miami region known as Little Havana. It's a unique slice of history and important to the history and fabric of South Florida's multicultural blend. Could East Little Havana, that's the area closest to I-95, be threatened by what's called upzoning? We'll learn more from two community experts. First, of course, longtime colleague of our history quizzes, some 45 of those, Paul, I believe. Of course, that's Dr. Paul George of Miami-Dade College and History Miami. He's conducted walking and boat and bicycle tours for decades here in Miami. Welcome to you, Paul George.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be back.
And also with us is Corina Mabius. She's an FIU doctoral student, a Little Havana tour guide, and a co-author of the book, A History of Little Havana. Welcome to you, Corina Mabius.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your tours that you guide.
Well, on my tours, I like to focus on introducing people to Little Havana, not only from a historical perspective, but also introducing them to the idea of what makes this community so special, to the individual business owners, to the cultural traditions that are practiced here, to get them thinking about what makes this such a walkable community where you see people greeting each other. And sometimes on the tours, we have an impromptu coffee with a business owner. We explore not just the Cayocho area, but we go outside of the areas where tourists often go. So they have really extraordinary experiences sometimes. And because I'm a resident of Little Havana, I like to share I think of it as sharing my neighborhood with them.
Why did you choose to live in Little Havana?
I had heard about Little Havana before I moved here, and I was spoiled in terms of walkable communities by living in Washington, D.C., which is a very walkable city. And I knew that when I moved here, I wanted to live in a place where I would be interacting with my neighbors, where I could walk to the grocery store, mm-hmm. where I could have that kind of community feel that I enjoyed living in the Adams Morgan area of Washington, D.C. And Miami developed in a time where the car and the suburb played an important role, and I knew I didn't want to live in the suburbs. I wanted to live in a place that had that sort of soulful feel to it. And my first job here actually was director of Viernes Culturales, Cultural Fridays, which is the monthly mm-hmm. arts and culture festival. And I was living in Little Havana at the time, but that sort of secured the deal. Like, this is the neighborhood I love. I felt embraced immediately, and I I knew this was going to be the neighborhood I was going to live in Miami.
Dr. Paul George, we're going to discuss some Little Havana zoning issues, but why don't you give us an overview of Little Havana, even going back to the 30s, when I understand it was a large Jewish community.
It was, Joe. It really begins...
Of course, you were born and raised in that area.
I was, when it was called Riverside, the area north of 8th Street. Shenandoah would be much of the area south of 8th Street. It really begins in 1904 at the Miami River. It was part of the original city limits, which extended as far west as 8th Avenue, northwest and southwest. And you started seeing these wood frame bungalows going up in the early 00s. And as Corinna said, it was always a walkable neighborhood and really charming and quaint. And it continued to grow west until it just enveloped everything up to 27th Avenue on both sides of 8th Street. The Jewish population... I began to grow considerably in the 30s, 40s, and even into the 50s. And then there's the move to suburbia, whether it's Westchester or straight out Cayocho. And that opened up a lot of places, both retail and homes. And it coincided with this tremendous influx of Cubans after the Castro takeover. There had already been Cubans in Little Havana prior to 60.
Yes. What's the Western Avenue boundary? Is that 37th Avenue?
That's the only thing we can't define. You can make a case that corridor, 8th Street, goes up to Chrome Avenue in terms of a Cuban presence. And the only thing that really gives 37th Avenue credence is the Versailles. For me, the western border, and this is all unofficial, will be 27th Avenue, with the exception of both Woodlawn Park Cemetery, where three Cuban presidents are buried, and the Versailles Restaurant, both of which are west of 27th.
Now, when did that area, when was it formed into the city of Miami? Did that come in along with the annexation of Alapata?
Yeah, it came incrementally. In 1913, the city borders extended out to 14th Avenue. In 1925, it just enveloped that area we're talking about, as well as Alapata, Silver Bluff, Lemon City, et cetera, Coconut Grove, all of those. That was during the great real estate boom in the mid-20s.
Now, on this, Corinna Mabius, on this business of upzoning, where are we now as for both of you, as far as what the City of Miami Commission is looking at and where they stand now and the readings and all that business?
Well, right now everything seems to be at a standstill. I think that there were expectations that it would pass easily originally by the folks who were proponents of it, but there has been such a huge outpouring of concern from residents and also people who feel strongly about the neighborhood who don't live in the neighborhood too, but realize that it's a very important historically and iconically, and also that it epitomizes a walkable neighborhood right now. It epitomizes placemaking that urban planners across the U.S. are trying to create these kinds of walkable neighborhoods, and we have that right now in East Little Havana. So it's there were over 250 people who signed a petition against it, and you know, good turnout at the first reading. But as far as we both know, right now we don't know when the next.
It's just sort of in limbo.
Yeah.
Right, it is. I just checked with the city's historic preservation chief, and it is in limbo. And a second reading hasn't come up yet. And again, it involves the most
historic. The first reading was in September, I believe.
Yeah, but the talk for it, the momentum began in the spring of this year. But Joe, it really encompasses an area we're talking about for the proposed upzoning that probably has the largest concentration of very old buildings, many of which are wood frame, anywhere within the city of Miami itself. And that's not even counting the area that's north of Flagler from the river up to 12th Avenue. And that also has a lot. But they're going quickly. There's no protection. And it's understandable, and also it's kind of disconcerting.
Now, the National Historic Association, whatever.
National Register.
Yeah, the Historic Preservation has put it on its most endangered list.
Right.
Is that correct?
For good reason. And Joe, a lot of the stuff's going down, not just because of the upzoning threat, which I consider a threat, but also because a lot of those are rental properties, they're in shambles, they're being taken down. But to walk or ride a bike through there, and I've done bike tours and walk tours through that area, is just enchanting. There is one real plus. Abra James, a noted historic preservationist, has bought the Miami River Inn, and she spent a fortune for it, and she's spending a fortune restoring it. And that's really close to the river. And that's a complex of five or six wood frames.
I'd like to bring in to join us by phone the new president of the Little Havana Residents Association. She's Raisa Fernandez, and she's resided in the area for many years. Welcome to you, Raisa Fernandez.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon.
Tell us your feelings on, first, living in Little Havana, and also this business of a possible upzoning of the eastern part of it.
I was born here in Miami and raised. I had Cuban parents and grandparents that lived in the area since 1965. So I was raised here with the love that they had. One time they moved away far, and they said, "Nope, we got to go back. We got to go back to close to everything." I think that my grandfather felt that because everything was so centralized, the businesses, the supermarkets, living close to there was something that I guess reminded him of where he grew up in Havana. So he wanted to stay close. He wanted to stay close to the beach, to downtown, to his business. He started a school bus transportation here around that time, and he just wanted to stay close. And so here I am now, born and raised here, and to me, this is home. This is where my parents grew up, where my grandfather found his second home after he came from Cuba, and this is where I am creating my home for my children. So it's home. It means a lot.
Now, in East Little Havana, exactly where is this proposed upzoning effort? Or would it be if it passes through the commission and other...
So the upzoning right now seems to be from I-95 bordering the river up to, I believe, is 4th Avenue, maybe 3rd, all the way to 12th Avenue, 2nd Street Southwest, all the way to 7th Street Southwest.
I think it's 6th Street, actually.
Sixth Street.
Yeah.
Okay. So 6th Street to the south. And so right now, I think Corinna mentioned it, that we're in a limbo right now. We haven't heard anything else. We haven't seen any public notice signings anywhere around the neighborhood. So we're just waiting and trying to stay vigilant and stay active.
Risa, since you've been a resident there long, has the ELH Eastern Little Havana changed much since you've lived there?
I believe it has changed. I think that there has been an increase of new businesses that have come, new residents, new development. It has changed, and it's something that we embrace at this time. But we do want to preserve what is attracted all these people, and that continue to attract people to move to the area. You know, the building should be preserved, and it's the character that makes this neighborhood special. You know, when I see my grandmother that lives in a 1928 bungalow, to me, the history of it, you know, when it was marketed and advertised as a, you know, as a vacation home to people from the north in that era, by the company of Sears, which is Roebuck, and I'm like, this is incredible. Like, my grandmother lives in one of these houses.
We're speaking with Risa Fernandez. She's the president of the Little Havana Resident Association. Also, Dr. Paul George of Miami-Dade College, and also FIU doctoral student and Little Havana tour guide, Corinna Mabius. We'll take a short break and be back with more.
Por eso quiero volver, tú sabes a dónde, a la Cuba mía.
Este es el son cubano, señor Cuba. Y
Oye, alele, la, 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 la. Y rescatar por fin al niño perdido en mi pensamiento. Oye, porque el tiempo y la memoria.
Recorded Calle Ocho, 2002.
Juegan juntos en nuestra historia.
Se me fue toda una vida.
Se me fue.
Celia Cruz.
Y tu imagen no se me borra.
Quiero volver sin mirar atrás. Poder vivir para perdonar. Quiero sentir, quiero regresar.
And also Willie Chirino singing La Cuba Mia, recorded in Little Havana just off of Calle Ocho, for a TV documentary, La Cuba Mia. We resume our conversation about Little Havana, particularly East Little Havana, with Dr. Paul George, Corinna Mabius, and also Raisa Fernandez. She's the president of the Little Havana Residents Association. And Raisa, tell us a little bit more about the neighborhood. Are there some rundown areas, some areas that need work?
Yes. There is definitely rundown apartments and homes and business properties in the area, which for many years we have tried to get our city officials to really try to enforce code enforcement in these buildings, really try to make it livable for a lot of the residents and for the area. You know, when we have shut down and run down buildings, it's just a creation for crime, for drugs, for other things in the neighborhood that we don't want. And sometimes it's very frustrating, and sometimes it happens, and it's done. And when it's done and they're restored and they are fixed up, we are amazed at how these buildings can look and these homes can look. So yes, there is, and we hope that maybe we can get our cities and our national organizations to maybe do grants or something so we can get property owners and maybe even renters that are there to become homeowners in these apartment buildings and in these homes. Because we know that when we increase home ownership in neighborhoods, it creates a good sign for the neighborhood. It increases civic engagement, and that's what we want. We want neighborhoods that include all that and that serve all, not just wealthy people that can buy expensive homes or afford to live in urban areas. Like we've seen with downtown and Brickell, they're very expensive. And yet we have this zoning already that it's multi-use. We have businesses, we have homes, we have multi-residential homes, apartments. So hopefully we can restore and preserve our neighborhoods and make it a big attraction for a lot of visitors that already come to see the neighborhood.
Dr. Paul George is a preservationist. Being that East Little Havana is so close to West Brickell, is that sort of a portent, a little?
Well, the area, especially south of 8th Street, on the other side, the west side of the expressway, is already beginning to experience some redevelopment of a large scale because it just is a flow right across the expressway from West Brickell. This area here is we're talking about is more or less west of the northern part of Brickell, but especially downtown. And yes, it could run over to that side too, and that's what upzoning is all about, is beginning to get that ready for it. Incidentally, Joe, I think, and Corinna lives in the area, the most quaint part of all of Little Havana and East Little Havana for me is the area that's extremely east because of the old house, because of the tall trees, because of the incredible human scale and the pedestrian life in that neighborhood. And I teach a class every semester in Miami, South Florida history. I take them down to Southwest 4th Street and 8th Avenue. It knocks her eyes out. The parks and what have you, the old churches. And I'd hate to see that area then kind of erased as we get into, you know, more development there.
Corina, what are some of the best sites for visitors who might want to come down from Broward County or something to visit East Little Havana? What are some of the good sites and good restaurants and things?
Well, I think there's a lot of energy at 12th Avenue and 6th Street. So many tourists and many visitors come to Calle Ocho, and that's the area that's most developed for tourism, to cater to tourists. But if you have already been to Calle Ocho and you want to explore elsewhere, you want to explore East Little Havana, I recommend that area around 12th Avenue and 6th, because to me that it sort of symbolizes this mix of our mom and pop businesses owned by not only people of Cuban descent, but people in our Central American community.
And yeah, I wanted to touch you on the multicultural aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, on this corner, for example, you have a Honduran restaurant with great baleadas and seafood, and you have another right across the street is a family-owned business by a Nicaraguan woman and her daughter. It's a wonderful little bakery. And then you have art studio galleries. You have a wonderful theater by Yoshvani Medin, who's a fantastic theater director and playwright, and Bridget Baker, who has a wonderful dance studio there. And then you have sort of some of these newer hip places like Little Bread, which has sort of the gourmet version of the Cuban sandwich, and across the street, another Central American business that just expanded. And to me, that's, you know, this vision of these small-scale mom-and-pop businesses that become successful and then they can get a little bigger. But you have sort of the old and new. You have young folks going there, hanging out there. You have older folks. You have Central American gringos like myself sometimes. And you have obviously people in our Cuban community and all hanging out and interacting. Other parts are very residential. So obviously, you know, if you want, you can walk down and see the architecture and walk down the residential streets. I personally like 6th Street a lot. And Flagler is interesting. Unfortunately, it's gotten a bit run down, but this Flagler and 12th, that was La Sauacera. I mean, that really was the place after 1959 where you had a lot of commercial activities and businesses within our Cuban community. And you still have some long-time businesses there and cafeterias and La Ideal, which is a wonderful little department store. But unfortunately, you see examples in East Little Havana of what is called in the planning community benign neglect. There has not been enforcement of code there, and properties have been allowed to be run down. And you have folks who are sort of sitting on properties on vacant land waiting to hoping that they can make a profit someday. And you have a lot of speculators who've been buying up properties in Little Havana right now. So you have more than a 30% increase in property values. And sometimes, you know, the folks who are buying these properties, they don't live locally. They don't interact with folks in the neighborhood. They'd have no sort of personal connection to the neighborhood. So to them, it's an investment. It's a way to make some money flipping properties. And of course, they have a big vested interest in this upzoning, which would massively increase the density of this area and is somewhat reliant on displacing current residents from their homes to bring in, you know, new residents, you know, people who don't live there yet.
Corina, you're the co-author of the book, A History of Little Havana. Wasn't this area for a while known as Little Vietnam?
There was an area known as
area.
Yeah, there was a stigma against the Mariel, who came in from the Mariel boat lift in 1980. But if you look at Miami history, drugs were coming into Miami in the 70s. It wasn't something that just started in 1980. But you did have an increase in crime in Little Havana, and you had a stigmatization of East Little Havana as a very dangerous place. But I And you also did, you had a presence of the Latin Kings. You had a very powerful gang operation from Chicago that moved down here and settled and was part of the whole drug trade. But unfortunately, the stigma of that time, which I think was also a stigma because you had new groups of folks moving into the area, and it was sort of, there was some, as we say in anthropology, ethnocentrism going on because folks looked different, or they were seemed as culturally different, or they weren't considered a different social class. Sometimes there can be a perception of crime that's greater than the actual crime.
There was a lot of fear and misunderstanding in those
days
post Mariel.
Because, and there's also a stigma that that's sort of still a really crime-filled place. But if you actually look at crime reports, the crime is not nearly as much as the perception of crime.
Raisa Fernandez, I was told that you need to be leaving the program about this time. You're welcome to stay. Otherwise, we'll say goodbye to you because we're going to take a break. Is that the case?
Thank you. Yes, I have to go. Thank you. Thank you all, and have a good afternoon. Thank you, Corinna. Thank you, Dr. Paul George.
Thank you. Raisa Fernandez is the new president of the Little Havana Residents Association. Little Havana Residents Association. And we'll continue our program with Dr. Paul George and Corinna Mabus after this. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman has the day off. She'll be back tomorrow. Tomorrow we will be featuring Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining with the restaurant Roundabout. Always a very popular program, so join us. And we're joined now by longtime colleague Dr. Paul George of Miami-Dade College and History Miami. You know him from this program quite well. And also with us is Corinna Mabius. She's an FIU doctoral student, a Little Havana tour guide, and a co-author of the book, A History of Little Havana. Corinna, tell us a little bit more about that book.
Well, I co-authored it with Dr. Guillermo Grenier, who is a sociologist and professor at FIU. And
I think he's been on this program.
Yeah, and he's a Cuban American himself, and he also has ties and feel a connection to the neighborhood. But we were looking at it sort of from the sociologist perspective and the anthropologist perspective, and so we talk about some of the politics, the political, and the sort of the role of the neighborhood as its and its significance as a place that people feel very nostalgic about, but we're focusing on the Cuban and Central American and other Latino presence in the neighborhood. So we actually talk about Dr. Paul George and because he has covered a lot in his book about Little Havana, but we're sort of taking it to more recent times up to, I think, 2010, but focusing on each chapter with a different decade. So 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000, and then 2010 to the present. But we're also talking about how there's a way that Little Havana gets imagined sort of as this iconic place, but also the fact that there's a lived community at the same time that people live in that's changing, that may
mean,
not
what
fit.
What do you mean by the imagined community?
Well, for example, you have folks who may have moved here in the 60s and have fond childhood memories of Little Havana, but then moved. And there's been different exoduses from the neighborhood. You know, 1980 is one example. And sometimes you have folks who move away and then continue to imagine a Little Havana in that way that they remembered in the 1960s. But also realize that it's an incredibly important political space. You've had very important marches, hunger strikes, that have taken there a lot of folks running for public office. They've got to do their appearance at Domino Park, for example.
When any incident was to do with Cuba, the reporters always ran to 37th Avenue and Calle Ocho.
Absolutely. So it has that.
Castro would be hanging
role.
An effigy.
but But the neighborhood has been changing. So you have, you know, sometimes folks, and for example, you have folks say, it's a Cuban neighborhood, but really it's a Latino neighborhood because it's, we now not only have folks from Honduras and Nicaragua who've also moved into the area, we have folks from different parts of South America and Central America and folks who are not Latino at all who move into the neighborhood. So there's a lot more diversity in the neighborhood than I think is sometimes recognized.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're talking about Miami's Little Havana. Number 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Also email, that's radio at WLRN.org. Radio at WLRN.org. Paul, what was it like growing up in that neighborhood?
It was a marvelous place, and there was already a mix of people when I was young, the Jewish population. There was a Syrian Lebanese club there. There was a Russian Orthodox church there, which is still there. It already had, in a very small way, diversity before that term was even used. We're talking now 50s and 60s. And, of course, by the 60s, things had really changed significantly with the Cuban influx. There were already numerous Cubans in the neighborhood prior to the Castro takeover. Yes. That's one reason why that became an entry point for a lot of Cubans.
Dead relatives, perhaps.
Right, and the hospitals are near, and the Catholic Church is near, churches are near.
Freedom Tower isn't that far.
Freedom Tower. So many people reminisce about walking from there right over to the Freedom Tower to pick up assistance, and that's become a big part of the neighborhood lore, too. But it was an absolutely darling neighborhood, very walkable. I walked with my father when I was a kid. The first book I did in Little Havana 25 years ago, I focused on the area from about 8th Avenue to the river. And looking back at that now, so much of those structures that I talked about there are gone, unfortunately. Yeah. But it was a great neighborhood. It was hilly, which for us is unusual. It had tall, leafy trees, still does. A lot of bungalows, has a certain amount of those still. As Corinna mentioned, Flagler and 12th was a major intersection. You know, before malls and suburbia, we had neighborhoods, and they all had their retail institutional intersections. Mm-hmm. And that was a very busy one. That was a parade route, Flagler Street. It was the widest street in that area. Because it was a main street leading into downtown.
The local drugstore, the Five and Dime.
Right. You had Robert's Drugstore. You had Holly's Five and Dime, a pharmacy, Royal Castle Hamburgers. I mean, everything was there. Nightclubs, optometrists, and a giant Firestone, which is now a Walgreens at 12th and Flagler. So it was really a compact neighborhood that had almost everything you needed.
Let's take a telephone call or two. First up, this is Ruben in Miami. Hey there.
Yes, sir. Hi, good afternoon. I was born in the mid-1960s, and I was born in the Silver Bluff neighborhood. So when I went to school, I had a very strong identity with Silver Bluff, and then I went to Shenandoah briefly before we moved away, and then there was Little Havana. But I'm wondering, what was the identity for those areas? What were they called before it was called Little Havana?
Well, the major areas, the generic names would be Riverside from the river west to at least 27th Avenue and north of 8th Street, and then Shenandoah from roughly 12th Avenue to 27th Avenue, south of 8th Street to at least Coral Way. And then Silver Bluff, it's very misleading. It's not just the area south of Coral Way from roughly 22nd Avenue to 27th Avenue, but it also was an incorporated municipality going back to 1913 that extended from South Bayshore Drive over into the area we know as Silver Bluff today. And then it was annexed to the city of Miami in 1925.
One last thing I'd like to add. You know, the street that I lived on as a kid in Silver Bluff is Southwest 25th Terrace. Mm-hmm. And that's the only street that still today does not have, you know, the curb that the rest of Silver Bluff has with the wider streets. And it has these little bungalows on 25th Terrace that I think may have been the first street even before Silver Bluff was developed.
It could have been, There was a lot of farmland there as far back as 100-plus years ago. There were some homesteaders in the area.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our number, 1-800-743-9576. And we'll talk about, we'll go to Clotilda in Miami Beach.
I think that's me, yes. Good afternoon, everyone. I would start by recommending the book that Corinna Mebius co-wrote with the other author. It's very refreshing because it's not written just like PR with a kind of a halo around it. It's full of all sorts of astounding revelations, and if you think you know South Florida, you read that book, and there are a lot of surprises. Yes, I am a little bit familiar with the effort that went into trying to stop the upzoning of Little Havana. And I wanted to put it in a larger context, which has to do with the real estate market down here in South Florida. And there's a big push to do upzoning anywhere. And Corinna mentioned earlier the benign neglect. And it's actually kind of funny to see how that is used by real estate interests. And then they have an influence sometimes on our elected officials. So they will zoom in on, you know, a homeless person or a bodega where they're selling drugs, and they'll say, see, the only remedy for this is to tear down everything and put up some investment condos. And they've been trying that here in South Beach and in Ocean Terrace, which was actually voted down. So I just wanted to, you know, sort of tie it in with a larger kind of pathetic picture, which is when you have a hot real estate market, people will use all sorts of bad faith arguments and tell you the only way to remedy blight is to tear down really remarkable neighborhoods. And if you look at like Soho in New York or Brooklyn, Greenwich Village, those places were very grungy once. You know, Ocean Drive was very grungy once. And you have to push back, and that's what we have to do with our elected people, because they're way too much under the influence of short-term real estate agendas. So.
Corinna, does that apply to Little Havana? Thanks for your call.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for your comments and the compliment on the book. Yeah, the stigmatizing, the portrayal of residents of East Little Havana, the criminalization of East Little Havana residents. I cannot, I've lost count of the number of times that I hear references to residents as if everyone who lives there is criminal, everyone there is doing illegal activity. And in a way, this is a you could see this as a strategy. If you portray people who live in a particular place in a negative light over and over again, and then you come in as the solution, that this is the solution, this is the one way to literally, you know, clean the place up, then that becomes the strategy to justify a displacement of these individuals, because they're seen as the cause of the conditions that people see in the neighborhood, as opposed to these other forces that are taking place, including benign neglect, that contribute to the condition of the neighborhood. So the blame is put all on the residents and not on these other forces.
Joe, let me just say something about this. The other side of what the caller talked about were the effort to reinvent these neighborhoods through upzoning, but the other side is the neighborhoods that have hung in there. Morningside, Belgrade, which is part of Maimo, East Buena Vista. Those neighborhoods are very historic. They've been restored, Palm Grove, and they've gotten really valuable just for the opposite reasons of what the upzoning advocates talk about. If you hang into a neighborhood, you keep the buildings up, you restore them, you've got a very valuable neighborhood. Morningside is untouchable price-wise. Instead of bailing out like everybody else did in that general area for the suburbs in the 60s, 70s, late 50s, they stayed. And so the other side of upzoning is if you hang in and fix up a neighborhood, it becomes very valuable.
Let's take a short break. We're talking about Little Havana on Topical Currents. And we're back. Joseph Cooper with today's Topical Currents. We're visiting with Dr. Paul George and also Corinna Mabius. We're talking about Little Havana, particularly East Little Havana. Both of my guests, I'd like you to talk about your respective tours before we get to the end of the program and I forget about it.
Well, Joe, just by a great coincidence, I have a Little Havana tour coming up this Friday as part of Cultural Friday. I've been doing it for 14 years. Every last Friday, this being an exception because of the holidays, it's free. And there's 10 different ones. This one's going to visit an old Bohemian area, which is on 11th Avenue, south of 8th Street. But then History of Miami, my beloved institution, is sponsoring a food tour, an ethnic food tour, this Saturday that I'm conducting. I've been really busy with the tours, and it's been marvelous, the experience.
And contact?
375-1492 or historyofmiami.org.
Okay. And Corinna.
Sure. Yes, my tours, my walking tours are typically 3 hours long. And right now, because I'm in grad school, I'm only doing private tours. But my tours focus on the Latino community. And one of the things I try to do is help dispel stereotypes about our Cuban community, our Central American community, and talk about, I tie in actually not only local history, but Latin American and Cuban history into the tour. And we do learn about food traditions, cultural traditions, spiritual traditions. We talk about politics.
You mean spiritual traditions?
Well, Little Havana is, Miami is a city where you have a large number of practitioners of Santeria, also known as Lukumi. And within Miami, Little Havana is a place where you have a lot of practitioners as well. And so not only do we go to... We do go to sites like many people know about the Ceiba tree in Cuba Memorial Park and Botanicas, but I talk about some of the symbolism that you find, the significance of the spiritual traditions to larger identities, etc.
And if someone would like to book one of those tours, how do they go about doing that?
LittleHavanaTours.com would be the way to do so.
Let's go back to our callers. Next up, it's Sylvia from Kendall. Hi there.
Oh, hi. Thank you. My question is about 12th Avenue and 6th Street, because I lived there when we first came to this country from Colombia, and it was that corner was totally residential. How could there be businesses there? I lived on a four-unit apartment building, and across the street there was a nice home, like built out of rock, where the couple would come only in the winter, and it had a big porch. And on the other corner, there was like a big, nice clinic for older people, well-to-do people, because it was very nice. Then the other corner was apartment buildings where Jewish people lived. But you mentioned businesses.
Yes, this is, and you're speaking about Southwest 12th Avenue and 6th Street?
Yes, right. And my sister and my brother, my little sister, went to Riverside Elementary School, which was just before Flagler and 12th Avenue.
Well, on one corner, it's interesting, on the northwest corner, there are businesses in what looks like it might have been a former bungalow.
Yeah, that was a home, but that's been retail. Alpha 66 occupied that in 1966, for example.
Oh, really? I don't go that way anymore, but I was fascinated by it. That was I was a teenager there. I had my first kiss on the steps of that building. And it was a real nice area. Jewish people. There were some Cubans there in the 50s because we came in 1950. Mm-hmm. And then there was that big clinic on the other corner.
Well, those stores that Karina was talking about on the north, the northeast side, have long been retail, and they were built going back to the 1920s. And then there was Murray's Pharmacy across the street where the Honduran restaurant is. But there were, on the west side of 12th, immediately north of 6th Street, there were some wonderful bungalows, long gone, with the exception of the one building that's been modified over time. But it was a jewel of a neighborhood. It really was.
And I wonder what happened to the building where I lived. Four units.
Yeah.
You'll have to come by there and see.
I have to. I have to, Mr. George. I really
yes,
have to.
I think you should.
Thank you. What a lovely program.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Sylvia. Corinna, can you give us a little bit of a recap of where we are and what we're discussing about East Little Havana and the possible upzoning for those who tuned in a little late?
Sure. Well, there has been an effort to increase the density of zoning from T4. This is from Miami 21 zoning, so that you can have more units per square acre than before. And quite quite an increase in density. It also allows for a mix of commercial and residential on a scale that you don't have currently. And, you know, I've talked to various developers and investors in the area who argue that one reason to do something like this is because, first of all, the folks moving from Brickell or wanting to, you know, just the demand on housing in the area, but also that they say that they can have units at a lower cost per unit if they're able to have more density on the site and if they don't have a parking requirement in addition. But you do see in East Little Havana in particular, where this zoning change is proposed, a lot of real estate speculation and prices, as I was mentioning earlier in the show, an average of about 30% increase within just a couple of years or less on the pricing. So there's a big concern that a lot of historical properties are going to be destroyed in favor of these denser building mixed-use projects, and that there's in turn going to be a huge level of displacement of existing residents.
It's easy to see the design, considering how close it is to downtown. It's close to Miami Beach. It has interstate highway in each direction. That neighborhood is very convenient.
It is. It eliminates the long drive for so many people. So you can understand how developers are really salivating at this. It's an ideal location. And downtown has been resuscitated and is coming back. So this is just an extension in the minds of a lot of people. It's just an ideal location. You know, we've reversed what we've done in America since the 50s, moving to the suburbs. Now we want to come back in for many reasons.
So the concern, though, is that right now this affects a swath of Little Havana where you already have a lot of walkability and you have green space and some lawn areas where kids play. Unfortunately, Riverside Park is being used much of the time by the Ada Merritt School, which is next door. And when it's in use, certain portions of that park and Riverside Park aren't even available for residents. And they're not, Little Havana is very limited in terms of its park space. So some of the concerns too is that upzoning takes away from the space for kids to play. And right now we have a lot of elderly who live in the neighborhood who are able to walk to various businesses and don't have to be confined into an old folks home per se. And you also have a lot of families and people walking to school and walking to different places. So that's part of this concern is that how will that change sort of the look and feel, the landscape, and this wonderful dynamic that you have here of neighbors talking to neighbors and et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, we certainly want to thank you, Dr. Paul George of Miami-Dade College and History Miami, and also Corinna Mabius, FIU doctoral student, a Little Havana tour guide, and a co-author of the book, A History of Little Havana. And as we said, this issue is sort of in limbo at this time, so if you have strong feelings, if you're a City of Miami resident, you might want to contact your city commissioner, correct, Paul?
Sounds good. That's Commissioner Croyo.
Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Raisa Fernandez of the Little Havana Residents Association. And that wraps us up. Thanks for tuning in. It was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. And as always, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. You can Google or Bing Topical Currents Archives for convenience. Also, check out the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, we hold another Linda Gastenheimer restaurant roundabout. We'll have critics on hand and take calls about the best dining spots from the Palm Beaches to the Keys. Any type is fine. Diners, steakhouse, pizza, vegan, Cuban. Joseph Cooper, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.